The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Guardian Football Weekly, the opening of Pep's Manchester City trophy cabinet. City wander past a limp Arsenal at Wembley in the Carabao. In the Premier League, Manchester United are quite interesting. Spurs win again, Dele Alli falls over again, and Liverpool fly past West Ham. At the bottom, Alan Pardew apparently has one game to save his job after defeat to Huddersfield. In the Football League, Wolves lose a game with Cardiff breathing down their necks. In Scotland, Scott Brown celebrates getting kicked by a player, and a goalkeeper gets kicked by a cow. All that plus your questions, feedback corner, and a conclusion to the Christian Vieri header saga. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Barry, for the final time, would you like to open your box?
And now the official ceremonial closing and throwing away of the box.
Amy Lawrence, how are you?
I'm joyous, thank you.
Yeah, I thought you would.
Glad to be sporting here.
A footballing injury.
Yes, I went in goal, which is a rare occurrence, as we were discussing for this pod, when you were quite chastising me about not, you know, putting my head down and wandering away when it was whose turn to go.
There's no bigger crime in five-a-side football than someone says, has everyone been in? And you know that that guy at the other end, he just hasn't, but he's so far away that he doesn't go in goal.
My punishment.
So you deserve that chubby grip that you have on your left hand. Lars, Liam has been in touch. He asks, what did Lars have for breakfast?
Well, can I shock you? I did not have breakfast this morning.
Well,
I've not had breakfast.
The game's gone.
I overslept a little bit, and then I figured I've got to rent for my train now. And then because it's a bit cold and this is England, the train was obviously cancelled. So I was furious. I was fuming out on the platform.
What would have breakfast? What would
this
breakfast
is the infuriating
been?
Thing. I think there's leftover pizza at home. So there's the ultimate me leftover breakfast at home, but I didn't have it. Which is why when you offered me a sugary treat just before the broadcast.
It's not a dog biscuit.
I said
that's
yes
a Ferrero Rocher.
With an enthusiasm that was entirely untimely. And that's just not because I'm excessively fond of sugary treats. It is because I haven't eaten anything, and that's not how I usually operate.
And then Max threw the Ferrero Rocher to you, and you handled it with all the skill and dexterity of Claudio Bravo.
Yeah, I'm about to say, I completely Claudio Bravo'd that Ferrero Rocher.
You were too far out of your goal.
I was.
Weren't you? Let's start with the Carabao Cup final then. Manchester City 3, Arsenal 0. Amy, how much do you want to talk about what this means for Arsene Wenger? I feel like the future of Arsene Wenger has never really been discussed.
No.
And this might be a great opportunity for us to finally decide if he should stay or should he, or he should go.
Do you know what? I've had so long to think about this.
10 years?
It is one of those things that you feel that, you know, you do get asked a lot, amazingly enough. And it's just so tiresome. And I suppose that's the thing where sort of is in the middle of listening to that kind of relatively passionate Gary Neville rant that he had during the match yesterday. He does get quite het up sometimes about Arsenal, Gary Neville, I've noticed. And
he said spineless. He was saying it's a disgrace for, I think, Ramsey and Xhaka.
I think
not
it was the way his voice went up about an octave when he went, but they're walking. walking football is not something for Gary Neville. I mean, when he gets that little bit older, I'm just wondering if, you know, and somebody's going to turn around to him at some point, you know, the legs are going a bit, he's... You might want a bit of exercise. Gary, would you like to come down and have a game of walking football? He's going to lose it. Where was I going with this? It was that sense of, you know, he almost sounded a bit shocked. And, of course, there's no point in being shocked about when Arsenal turn in one of these sort of fairly insipid performances anymore because it's become increasingly commonplace. I feel a bit like we ought to start off by talking about Man City, but you have thrown the negative straight at me. But going back to this sense of, you know, it's not a surprise anymore. I mean, I was thinking about how Arsenal lost 6-1 against Manchester United back in 2001. And, you know, that was an extraordinary moment. That was a moment to be shocked because they were a very, very good team there. And to have that sort of fall apart, complete crumbling display was unexpected. But Arsenal have become quite accustomed to this now, so there isn't that same sense of of disgust, really. I think there's almost an apathy that it engenders. And I'm really interested to see what the crowd is going to be like on Thursday when Man City go to the Emirates in the league. Because since Arsenal moved from Highbury to the Emirates, you know, crowds in recent seasons have become, you know, noticeably a bit more sparse. But big games, the so-called Category A ones, have always been very, very well attended. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily going to be the case this time. But just mentioning that 2001 game against Man United just reminds me of one of my favourite football stories. So if you indulge me a moment.
Absolutely.
It involves Igor Stepanovs. Igor Stepanovs appeared in a pre-season for Arsenal once when they were on tour somewhere in Austria in front of not very many people. And he played in a training game just for Arsene Wenger to have a look at him. He'd obviously been scouted. There was this big centre-back from Latvia. You know, he looked like a bit of a unit. And Tony Adams was coming towards the end of his career. Martin Keown was getting on. It was time to think about investing in, you know, fresh blood and the big centre-back department. And Martin Keown was on the bench watching. And whenever there was a new centre-back in town, or potentially so, he would get very twitchy. So his teammates, who were sat just next to him at this pre-season game, just saw this as too much of a, you know, an opportunity. So particularly Dennis Bergkamp, who used to like to have a bit of a joke at Martin Keown's expense, mainly because Martin Keown used to kick him around in training, spent the entire of this game going, he was sat behind Arsene Wenger, Dennis Bergkamp at the time, saying, "Oh, he's, every time he shots the ball, oh, I like the look of this new centre-back. Like, you know, he looks quality." And I don't think he was even playing that well, but every time he got anywhere near the ball, Dennis complimented this new big centre-back bloke on trial in Arsene Wenger's ear, only and purely to try and get a rise out of Martin Keown. Stepanov spends a week on this training camp and then disappears. And when they turn up for the first day of regular training back in London, there's Igor in the dressing room. All the Arsenal players looked at each other and went, "Igor, what are you doing here?" He goes, "Arsene Wenger gave me a 4-year contract." Anyway, they were kind of amused, and life went on. And then suddenly there was this game at Old Trafford and Arsenal had an unbelievable injury crisis and Igor was in. And needless to say, Manchester United were very convincing. And I think they were 3 or 4 goals up by half time. Dwight Yorke got a hat trick. And as they were going off the field at half time, Dwight Yorke was walking, there's quite a long walk off to the tunnel, walking next to, I think, Ray Parlour, and said to him, "Where'd you get that centre back from?" Ray Parlour goes, "Oh, it's a bit of a long story."
Although, you sort of think Igor Stepanov might have headed the ball away for Man City's first goal. I mean, that was, Barry, that was sort of Sunday league defending, wasn't it? One drops, one goes for the header. That doesn't happen.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you could charitably suggest it was a foul by Aguero, but even so,
stupidly, I think, is the word. I mean, it's not nowhere near a foul. It can't be.
Why not?
But shouldn't you be behind that player anyway?
Yeah, he should have been goalside at Aguero. Yeah, it was a terrible mistake. And I think he was sort of culpable for all 3 goals. Well, it's certainly the second as well. But it's difficult to know. You know, there's only so much Arsene Wenger can do. He can't
train his players to defend.
Well, I'm sure he does train his defenders to defend, but you know, that if a child did that, you'd be slightly agog at the naivety of it. But it's, you know, Mustafi is a good player. You know, he plays for Arsenal, he plays for Germany, he's represented Germany at 2 major tournaments. But when these players get Arsenalified, you know, they become capable of these errors and capable of making them on a frequent basis. I mean, Manchester City didn't even play particularly well yesterday and didn't need to. And they still ran out easy winners because Arsenal's players didn't seem particularly motivated to play in a final, as if they knew they were beaten before they even, you know, walked out of the tunnel.
But there is a point there about leadership at the club, because an interesting point of comparison, I think, and that's to do with what we were talking about with the walking football, in the United game, which we'll come on to, just after United scored, they were kind of... No, after Chelsea scored, sorry, United were sort of further wrong-footed by a short free kick from Chelsea, and they almost had a good chance of it. But if you look, if you watch that back and you look at the extraordinary desire of the United players to get back, like some of the sprints getting back into the box to crowd out Hazard there, it's quite the commitment they showed to getting back in their own box to defend is extraordinary. And if you compare that to how Arsenal defended in many phases of the game at Wembley, I mean, there is a tangible difference there. And it isn't, as you say, it's not just you down to personnel, because Mustafi is not a hopeless defender. I mean, he does some weird things, but it's interesting how at Arsenal it's so lax.
But I think, you know, Arsenal were able to do that last season in the FA Cup final and semi-final against challenging opposition. You know, it's not that long ago. But if you look at this season, there just seems to be less consistency, less instances where they're able to rouse themselves and get focused and show that level of determination. And then the North London derby at home was probably, you know, the one performance that stands out where they were really highly motivated and had that determination across the pitch all game long. But how often are they able to summon that? And it's not often enough. And I think you have to look at the bigger picture and say that obviously you brought up the Arsene Wenger question at the beginning, but do you really think that a change of manager is suddenly going to turn Arsenal into a top four side with what's going on and the teams that they want to be judging themselves against?
Well, if you're saying
there does seem to be quite a bit that I think is going to need fixing. Yeah. I don't think it's going to be a magic wand
scenario.
Sure,
personnel wise, but
there's
if,
a change
if
there.
You're saying the last time and one of the few times Arsenal got themselves up for a game, surely it just seems like it seems obvious that you've got to motivate your players.
And I think that North London derby in November, like you say, is an interesting reference. I actually mentioned that in my preview of the game, because what they did then is that they just... It was funny because going into the match, all the talk was about the intensive pressing that Spurs do and how Arsenal are a bit wishy-washy. And then the whistle went and it was completely opposite. Like Arsenal came out at 100 million miles an hour and just completely pushed Spurs off their game plan. And I was expecting them to do something similar, because as hard as it is and as much of a high-risk gambit as it is to press Man City, it has been shown to work this season when Liverpool's done it. Even when Bristol City did it for periods. I mean, I think the way... Stopping Man City is almost impossible, but one of the ways you can do it is to try to not allow them to get into their rhythm and not allow them to get their passing going. And having seen Arsenal do just that to Spurs at the Emirates, I was kind of expecting them to do something similar, but they were so, you know, lax. The lack of intensity there was weird, I thought.
Can we praise Man City before somebody gives us abuse for not talking about them? Great for, you know, their sort of older players, you know, Aguero, Silva, and especially Vincent Kompany.
Yeah, I mean, they deserve praise for winning a cup final, but they didn't have to do much to win it.
It's Arsenal, isn't it?
It really is. It's, you know, I was looking back through domestic cup final scores this morning just to see when's the last time anyone gone tonk that much. Arsenal beat Villa 4-0 in the cup final a couple of years ago. But beyond that, you have to go a long way back to see a Premier League team getting beaten by more than one or two goals in a final, you know. And Arsenal were pretty lucky it was only three, you know. I think City kind of took mercy on them and, as I said, didn't play particularly well and didn't need to play particularly well. But it was great for Vincent Kompany, you know. I think everyone likes him, and he's suffered from so many injuries. It's good to see him lifting a trophy and scoring a goal as well, and he was clearly delighted. But, you know, while you can praise City for and congratulate them for winning this trophy, they didn't have to do much. It was made pretty easy for them.
Amy?
Can I praise Vincent Kompany a bit more effusively?
Sure.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
I think that if we try and put a bit of perspective on all of this, when we project into the future and we will look back on, you know, this era of Manchester City and how they've transformed themselves in these last few years, his presence and his ideas, I think the way he conducts himself as a human being as well as a footballer, has played a really massive part on that team. And usually the centre-backs are not the guys who we, you know, we look back on when we're thinking about a great team, and they become the symbols of it. And he deserves to be very symbolic of what Manchester City have done in reinventing themselves. And I think the moment that, apart from the goal, stands out for me is when he had a foot race with Aubameyang.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, I think that he started off a little bit behind. And that determination that we just talk about, that professional sense of I'm going to be the best that I can be at any given minute on the pitch, where you just knew he was going to give every sinew that he had, he was going to push it to the limit to try and make sure he got there first. Apparently, he was asked about that after the game. Was it you who tweeted this and said he laughed about it? Or something?
Yeah, no, it wasn't.
No. But, you know, it must have been an enjoyable moment for him, because it was probably not expected that he'd win a foot race against someone who's supposed to be very pacey.
Was I the only one who was actually a bit worried when he was celebrating his goal? Because he's been injured in so many interesting ways, and he was sort of jumping around like a lunatic, and people were piling on a bit. I was like, careful now.
Don't do a knee slide.
He's very fragile. He's had all the injuries, lads. Don't just give him some space.
Did you, Arsene Wenger, in his post-match, revealing a conversation he had with the fourth official, Graham Scott, after complaining the referee had it on and not added on enough time? When I said, why do you not give more time? Graham Scott said, why do you want more time? Which is fair enough. And Mark says, in finance news, the Carabao box that you ceremonially threw away a second ago might be a collector's piece. Share prices in free fall in Thailand after the fixed price on cane sugar was axed. Ooh. So there you go. And next up for Arsenal, yeah, Thursday they play Manchester City again. Then they go to AC Milan. That's their season is AC Milan in the Europa League really now, isn't it? And Milan did not start the season well, but they beat Roma at the weekend. Unbeaten in eight. Six of those are wins. We'll have more from Paolo's Piazza this week. Barry, I hate to...
Why? Piazza's been commandeered by someone who actually knows what they're talking about.
Can pronounce one word in Italian as well. And in other Manchester City news, Sam El-Nasri is set to be banned from football for 6 months. Because of a drip treatment he took at a Los Angeles clinic in 2016.
Yeah, that drip treatment worked out well for him.
He took the treatment while on holiday, but it contravenes World Anti-Doping Agency rules.
Intravenes, don't you mean? Yeah.
Very good.
Thank you.
Anyway, reports in Spain have suggested the ban will be made public today. Well, I presume it's made public, otherwise I didn't know about it before. I didn't have intel on what's dripping into Sami El-Nasri. We should mention, before we finish criticising Arsenal, their defeat to Östersunds in the Europa League on Thursday. But you went to the away leg where they won comprehensively.
They did, although I have to put a little bit of context in that, which was Östersund were really, really disappointed with the fact that they started clearly a bit inhibited and overwhelmed by the occasion, and that was something they obviously wanted to put right in the second leg. And I've got a lot of admiration for the fact that they turned up for an away game at a big club 3-0 down, and you know, a lot of teams probably wouldn't put that much effort into that situation. But what they really wanted to do was show their real selves, and that they were a much better team than they managed to show of themselves in the first game in Sweden. And they are a good team with some good players, who probably a few of them will get picked off, I would have thought, by some bigger teams after the way they've made a quite a big noise this season in Europe.
Before we move on from this game, Barry, your thoughts on Pep's yellow ribbon?
Yeah, he's been wearing this yellow ribbon in solidarity with some four Catalan leaders who've been in jail since the Spanish, or the referendum, the independence referendum, which the Spanish government deemed illegal. And I think most of his, or at least half, if not more, of his press conference after the game yesterday was devoted to talking about that. He was charged on Friday by the FA for, you know, making a political statement, and if he gets a fine, he said, I accept the fine if I broke the rules. I'm a human being and this is for humanity. So that's all well and good, but you know, he's all for this, you know, human rights of these Catalan leaders. But 4 years ago, or 4 or 5 years ago, this French footballer who was sort of trapped in Qatar, whose World Cup bid Pep is a well-paid ambassador for, wrote a letter to Zinedine Zidane, who's also an ambassador for the, or was an ambassador for the bid. He was trapped in Qatar.
Zahir Balounis.
Zahir Balounis is his name, yeah. And was he couldn't get an exit visa. You know, workers in Qatar, you can't leave the country unless you're given an exit visa. And because he was in a pay dispute with his club, he couldn't get his and was basically a prisoner in his own apartment. And wrote to Pep asking for help and got precisely none. So, you know, Pep seems to... He's quite happy to spread political messages unless they don't hit him in the pocket, it seems.
And it would seem, like, since he's brought up politics, Pep has, it would seem like an opportune moment to remind everyone that Man City are, of course, funded by Abu Dhabi, one of the United Arab Emirates. And I'd like to take a moment now to read from the Human Rights Watch page on the United Arab Emirates, detailing that the government arbitrarily detains, and in some cases forcibly disappears, individuals who criticise the authorities, and its security forces face allegations of torturing detainees. A new anti-discrimination law further jeopardizes free speech and is discriminatory as it excludes references to gender and sexuality. Authorities denied access to the country to activists who criticized the UAE's mistreatment of migrant workers, and this is a key line I feel, the United Arab Emirates often uses its affluence to mask the government's serious human rights problems. And I'm looking at you, Man City. I mean, as much as we can admire and praise what they do on the pitch, we frequently have a go at PSG for being a sort of slightly gaudy advertising hoarding for the Qataris on this podcast, and rightly so. There's a lot of that at Man City as well.
If you were a Man City fan, what would you do about that? Would you stop going? Would you? I mean, it's difficult because there's a. I don't know where you draw the line, and I don't know how many fans look at where the money comes from to any club.
Well, I mean, we were talking about what a great fellow Vincent Kompany is, and I don't doubt it for a second, but I'd kind of be interested to know what his opinions are, that he's almost certainly not allowed air, or, you know, is diplomatic enough not to air. But I'm not a Manchester City fan, so it's not something I have to worry about.
Manchester United beat Chelsea 2-1. Were United more entertaining than they have been previously, Lars?
I guess it wasn't quite as boring a game as one might suspect. I mean, given some of the United games against the other top teams, I thought it was quite decent, yeah. And there were promising signs, especially I thought there was glimpses of a burgeoning sort of partnership and understanding between Sanchez and Lukaku, which I think is key for them. As we've talked about a number of times, Jose Mourinho doesn't really work on the sort of... coordinated attacking moves in the same way that other top managers do, so he is very reliant on his individuals in offensive positions on the pitch, you know, having a good understanding and creating things on their own. I thought you saw Sanchez and Lukaku starting to do that. It was a decent performance, but they were also a little bit fortunate because Chelsea could have been more than 1-0 up. They were very good at the beginning of the game, and you look at it was one of those, I quite like him, but it was one of those games where you look at Morata and there was an interesting point of comparison later on that evening with Diego Costa. I don't know if you saw this, but he had like the most Diego Costa moment for a long time in the Sevilla-Atletico Madrid game, in which he fouled an opponent, then feigned an elbow to the face, and then hunted down some possession, and then scored the opening goal in a very typical sort of bullying Diego Costa manner. And it was just all of Diego Costa in like one-minute segment. And as much as Morata is a very capable forward who is good at a lot of things, and I'm sure he's going to score a heck of a lot of goals in his career, he lacks a lot of what the Diego Costa has, that sort of terrifying sort of ability to bully other teams. And if you're a centre-half and you have the option between playing 90 minutes against Morata and playing 90 minutes against Diego Costa, that's a no-brainer, you know? And you do wonder if with a different forward, the season could have been slightly different for Chelsea.
David Barry says, after Thursday's scathing attack on Mourinho about him being a bully and petty, I hope he's given the credit he deserves on the Monday pod. It's only you and I, of the four of us, were here. And I asked the question, so you have to take this one, Barry.
What?
Because are you going to give
Manchester
him the credit?
United beat Chelsea, he's no longer a bully?
That's how it works.
Oh, okay.
No, just do you want to give Jose some credit for...
Yeah, he made good substitutions that turned the game, and his were far more effectual than Antonio Conte's. And I would say that will kill Antonio Conte. He made a big show before the game of going to shake. He shook every Chelsea player's hand in the tunnel and was, you know, you could see Antonio Conte trying to avoid him so he wouldn't have to shake his hand. But did so anyway before the game started. And I would say that defeat will really rankle with Antonio Conte, because the changes he made, bringing off Eden Hazard, seemed a bit weird and it backfired on him. Whereas Jose Mourinho brought on Jesse Lingard, changed the game and then sort of closed things down, bringing on Eric Bailly. And yeah, he deserves credit for that. I don't see how it has anything to do with what I said on Thursday, though.
Amy, Chelsea are out of the top four. Do you think they'll miss out?
I still think there's enough football to be played between now and the end of the season that I wouldn't want to put my hat on anyone to miss out. I mean, Man City are obviously going to take one of the spots. I still think you can easily take any three out of Manchester United, Chelsea, Tottenham and Liverpool. And I wouldn't particularly say that anyone has got it nailed or anybody's a favourite to not make it. I'm really interested. There's a couple of big games coming up that I think are going to tell us a little bit more. Obviously, Man United and Chelsea involved, two of them against each other. But quite soon, we've got Man United against Liverpool. And you were just talking about the Jose Mourinho, is he boring, is it less boring scenario. And of course, that particular fixture earlier on in the season, the 0-0 was one of the ones where Mourinho's approach was particularly criticised for being negative and just about containment and so on. And, you know, it's at Old Trafford, so there should be, I think, more emphasis for Manchester United to try and have a go at Liverpool. But given the way that Liverpool are attacking, that's going to be a bit of a risky strategy. So whether he tries to go out again to stifle and just make sure that he avoids defeat in that game, or whether he thinks that United are in a position to try and go and win it, I think is going to tell us quite a lot about how both those teams fare in the next
week. Yeah, Man City play Chelsea next weekend. United-Liverpool is the week after. Let's go to the bottom of the table. West Brom 1, Huddersfield 2. 7 points adrift, Barry. One game to save his job for Alan Pardew. I mean, if he does go, that's not a great little bit for your CV, is it?
No, and I'm not sure why he's been given one more game, because even if West Brom do beat Watford, they're still going to be mired in relegation trouble, and it isn't going to mean that Alan Pardew is suddenly the man to keep them up. I don't think anyone could keep them up at this stage, to be honest. I mean, they need 3 wins to get out of the relegation zone, at the very least,
yeah.
Which is as many wins as they've recorded in the last calendar year or something like that.
Well, they won the first 2 games of the season, West Brom.
Well, I remember we were talking about how great it would be if they won the Premier League, winning every single match 1-0. I didn't foresee this happening, but, you know, the thing about appointing Pardew is you get, well, you're supposed to traditionally get this lift, or this immediate, the Pardew swing, and that never materialised. I think the only decent performance they put in since he took over was in the Cup against Liverpool, which is probably a win they could have well done without. I think they should cut him loose now, although I don't think it will make much of a difference, because I can't see them staying up.
Here are some quotes from him. It's not for the want of trying. I've gone into my records and used most of my repertoire, but I've still got a few things to go. Seems strange that he would keep anything in, you know?
Yeah, I'm interested to know what's in this repertoire. I mean, they had no intensity about them at all. He didn't seem to have a clue what to do. He looked totally broken on the touchline. And even when he was asked about his future afterwards, he didn't seem entirely convinced he'd still be in a job today. And I'm kind of surprised he is, at the time of recording, still in a job. And, you know, if you compare and contrast the way Huddersfield went about their business, the players just harrying relentlessly, pressing, there was none of that from West Brom. And they could conceivably have rescued a point, but, you know, Dawson pulled a goal back for them from Chris Bunn's corner and almost scored an identical one later, but his effort went over the bar. But they look a beaten docket.
Lars, I like it when you have something to say, because it's a bit like, you know, the really keen kid at primary school who just puts his hand up and then keeps his sort of hand up, holding it up with another hand, eager to come in.
Well, I just, I just want to say that I have some sympathy for Alan Pardew. I'm not convinced he's an amazing manager by any stretch. But I think this is a team that's been constructed to play Tony Pulis football. You know, you have rugged defenders, you have sort of ball-winning midfielders, and you have a big forward up top, and you don't have much else, really. So when he comes in halfway through the season and he wants them to play a little bit more expansive, because, you know, a part of you doesn't coach Pulis ball, really. He wants them to play a bit with a bit more freedom and a bit more attacking. You don't really have the players to do that. And you also, when you take over in the winter time, you don't have a lot of time on the training ground because there's so many games, like in England.
And it's cold.
Yeah, in England, I mean, it reminds me when Ole Gunnar Solskjaer took over at Cardiff. He like wanted to completely change the way they played, but there were like record rainfalls in South Wales at that time. So they had almost no trainings because there were loads of water on the training pitch all the time, and he couldn't get the team to do what he wanted to do because like he had no time with them. And I think it's really hard to change the way a team plays halfway through the season, and he doesn't really have the personnel to do it anyway. If your central midfield is Gareth Barry and Gregor Kukoviak, Kukoviak has been good in the past, but in a sort of enforcer capacity, he's better at kicking people than kicking the ball, I'd argue. And same thing you could say about Barry, and to an extent the same thing you could say about Livermore. I mean, where's your playmaker in this team? Who's going to distribute the ball? So this is the team that's created a very sort of Pulisian fashion, and when you try to do something else, they're probably not going to be very good at it.
Thank you, Lars. That'll do for part one. We'll be back in a second and we'll start with Liverpool. Welcome back to part two. Before we crack on with Liverpool West Ham, Barry, we're live in Dublin tomorrow night.
Toorooloo.
Fiddle-dee-dee.
beat dad.
It's snowing all day today. Tomorrow night, 4 to 6 centimetres of snow predicted in Dublin. So we may not make it. If we do make it, we may be stuck in Ireland. There are 30 tickets remaining. And I think if we are going to be good enough to go there in this awful weather, you should come if you're near Dublin.
Yes,
I mean,
yes,
clearly,
please do.
If it's, don't travel unless it's safe to do so.
Go on, cancel. You're grand. You'll be grand.
So that's it. Come to see us in Dublin. Me, Glenn Denning, Wilson and Barney Ronay chatting about...
Can you imagine the amount of tedious bickering we'll have to listen to from Wilson and Ronay if we do get marooned in Ireland? You can all come and stay in my parents' house. I'm sure Ma and Paul Glenn Denning would be delighted.
Is that the panel or the audience too?
Just the panel.
Okay. The snow weather warning sets in at 3 p.m. on Tuesday and lasts until 11 on Wednesday morning, which is the exact hours that we will be in Dublin. We are bringing the snow. Please come and laugh at the appropriate times. Oh, and also listen to the insight and all that. Right, let's crack on then with the Premier League. Liverpool 4, West Ham 1. Amy, they're quite fun. I mean, they're just a joy, aren't they, those three to watch? And you think when Coutinho left and there was a bit of fear about what might happen, but there didn't need to be because Salah, Firmino and Mane are really good at football.
Yeah, they really are. And I think you're totally right. The Coutinho element to it is what must make it even more gratifying for Jurgen Klopp and, you know, for Liverpool fans and so on, is that obviously you're going to have some concern middle of the season if you're losing one of your most creative players. But the way that they've just, I don't know, taken what they were doing before and run with it, literally. But quite apart from them, I particularly enjoyed the match of the day analysis of Robertson, actually, because I think it's very easy to give the credit to the goal scorers, obviously, and, you know, Salah, Firmino and Mane have got a great kind of natural telepathic vibe going on where they're attacking collectively, and it is clearly overwhelming for a lot of Premier League defences and indeed in Europe. But I felt like that was a real interesting analysis because clearly that energy that he brings and the quality of the crosses has been a fantastic asset. But also the fact that here's a kid who joined Liverpool and didn't find it that easy in the first few months and has had to bide his time a little bit to feel that he can express himself in the way that he is now, shows just another example of, you know, we make quick judgments all the time in football, and if somebody is given a bit of space and a bit of time and not too much pressure and allowed to fit in, that can be a good thing.
I'm struggling to work out if there's a better left back in the league at the moment, actually.
Is it maybe time to have a little bit of a word of praise for the much maligned Liverpool FC transfer committee? They've gone through a period now where they've signed, you'd have to say they've signed really well. Obviously, the headlines will be about all the money they spent on Van Dijk, but he does seem to be settling in very well. But Robertson as well is a very canny pickup there. Salah has obviously been the sensation. And they are a club that use the dreaded statistics for a lot of their recruitment, I'm led to understand. And it seems to be working quite well for them.
Well done. You've done it. Bournemouth 2, Newcastle 2. This was a fun game, Barry, wasn't it? Newcastle 2 up there. I mean, Perez's chance at 2-0 up was
Yeah, Iosa Perez missed a wonderful opportunity to kill the game off for Newcastle. Jonjo Shelvey missed a good chance. Mixed game for Jonjo Shelvey. I think we saw the best of him and the worst. And, you know, there has been a bit of a clamour. I suppose clamour is maybe too strong a word for him to be included in the England squad. And we saw instances in that game, particularly his ball from deep to help set up the first goal for Dwight Gayle was wonderful. But he's a bit undisciplined when it comes to tracking back, to doing his defensive duties, and could be sort of not held directly responsible, but certainly partly culpable for both the Bournemouth goals.
Which the first goal was a great goal, actually. Was it Adam Smith who scored it? It was a lovely strike, in off the bar. Any goal that in off the bar is better. Bournemouth are now...
Was that the one with the nice dinky little back heel from Lewis Cook
as
well?
Yeah. And rumours of Lewis Cook going somewhere.
To Liverpool.
Is it Liverpool? He's a very good footballer, isn't he? Bournemouth up to 11th with that point. Newcastle are 15th. Brighton are 12th in between them. 4-1 win over Swansea, Amy. Four games without a defeat now for Chris Hughton.
Yeah, I think they, you know, again are being rewarded for sort of a quite calm approach to life in the Premier League. Probably would have been understandable for them to have got a bit giddy to be in this company for it being such a long time that they've been aspiring to get up here. But I think that, you know, I saw them fairly early in the season a couple of times and it did look like scoring goals was going to be the problem for them. And they've tried to recruit and they're just playing with a little bit more enthusiasm, I think, across their attack. And they feel confident, they're good at home. And I think for them to just stay in the division is going to be a fantastic achievement, and I would back them to do so.
Glenn Murray's got four in his last four now, and Lacadia scored. Barry, you like his rap videos? Is like too far?
Well, it's not the video specifically, more the actual music.
Okay.
Yeah, it's okay. But when it comes to young Dutch footballers making rap videos, my expectations are generally very low, and his was surprisingly good.
Do you not think maybe Chris Hughton, his public image might be a bit different, like if he said more wacky things or had a fun nickname or something? Because he seems like the kind of guy who just does a really good job and has done a really good job pretty much everywhere he's been. Producer Mel may disagree. I mean, the Norwich thing didn't really work out, but that was not a great squad he was working with either. He's consistently done well pretty much wherever he's been, Chris Hughton. And he just seems like a very lovely man who does a really good job. And he doesn't say anything crazy in press conferences. There are very few, like, in-depth articles detailing all the fascinating tactical work he does. Like, that doesn't seem to happen either. So he just seems to be there, and he seems to do very well. And I think he's underrated by an awful lot of people.
He honed his skills on the mean streets of South London, Stockwell specifically. He was an apprentice lift engineer with Otis Lifts. And his boss used to drink in a pub in Stockwell called the Beehive. So while he was in lorrying back pints, Chris was left outside in the van eating crisps and drinking bottles of Coca-Cola, waiting for the gaffer to come out so they could go and service more elevators.
How old was he then?
I don't know, 15, 16. Oh. Too young to go into the pub.
it must be great having a manager who can also fix the lifts. Like, brilliant. If they break down in the stadium, just get the gaffer in. He knows how to sort this out.
The beehive in question, it's no longer a going concern, but I suspect if he'd really wanted to go in for a pint, they wouldn't have been that fuss.
Josh says, is Carlos Carvajal so nice he's willing to get his club relegated so the police don't have to deal with two Premier League South Wales derbies as Neil Warnock thoughtlessly gets Cardiff promoted? Ellis is back on Thursday, so we'll get Swansea in depth then. Crystal Palace, they are one place above the drop zone, same points as Swansea. They held out Spurs for 88 minutes, and Harry Kane looked like he was having one of those games, but he just is pretty relentless, and his goal-scoring record is ridiculous. It's the fourth 1-0 win for Spurs against Palace in this fixture. 1-0, 2016-17, Wanyama, 83rd minute. 0-1 Spurs, Eriksen, 78 minutes. This season, Spurs won Palace 0, Son in the 64th, and Kane in the 88th. So it seems like Palace hold out Spurs for a little bit, but just can't quite manage it.
I felt a bit sorry for Palace, actually, because that was a heroic effort, considering how many players they have out injured. And, they very nearly held out for a point that would have been a brilliant point for them to win, but such is life. Oh, and Dele Alli, gravity got the better of him again, it seems. He's getting quite the reputation and becoming very unpopular.
Poch says he's being targeted unfairly.
I wouldn't say it's unfair. I'd say it's entirely fair. But
I'm a very big fan of Serge Aurier's foul throw extravaganza.
Oh, yeah, please.
That was amazing.
Should be a 10-game ban for a foul throw.
But I also
three
like
them in one
I
game.
I know, you should be banned for 30 matches.
But I quite like referees actually pulling it up, because you actually see quite a few throws that are like, that's pretty much almost a foul throw. But referees are just kind of, yeah, whatever. Like, there's no point doing that because it becomes silly. But I like that we have at least one referee who's
you can just see
zero tolerance of foul throws.
The disappointment on the teammates' faces. And that happens at any level of football, doesn't it? A foul throw. Come on, Serge. Burnley 1, Southampton 1. A great point for Southampton. And well done for Bobby Madley for getting an assist. Must be the worst thing for... I mean, I don't know what the worst thing for a referee is, but to get in the way and stop an attack from one side and then the other team to get a last-minute equaliser, Barry, is pretty low on the list of things referees want to do.
Yeah, but, you know, the referee is technically part of the pitch, so it's an unfortunate mistake, but what can you do?
Burnley haven't
apart
won since...
from get out of the way.
Sure, we could have done. Burnley haven't won since December. And Lars, we all know you hate Burnley, so you must be over the moon.
I was simply making the case earlier in the season when they were flying high that looking at their numbers, there'll be some kind of regression to the mean at some point. And lo and behold, that appears to have happened. But I do admire the fact that they're still seventh, in spite of not having won since the 12th of December. They've scored 22 goals in 28 games and they're seventh.
Yeah, it's amazing.
That's interesting.
For a bit of nostalgia and Southampton nostalgia, 24 years ago today that Matt Le Tissier scored the chip-up free kick against Wimbledon, was it? So well done, Matt. You were great at football. Leicester 1, Stoke 1. Lovely goal from Shaqiri. And a Jack Butland mistake. He made a great save after that. It begs the question, Amy, who, if you were made England manager, who would you put in goal tomorrow? I mean, don't be that disappointed to get the job. You get paid well, you know. You'd have to deal with some Twitter abuse.
I'd go Butland, Pickford, Pope in that order.
And play all of them?
Oh, just one at a time.
With England, are we at the point now where it's almost just tempting to ask one of the outfielders to go in goal? Can you just get Jake Livermore to
by
do it
side.
Or something and
come
just
on,
see
who's
how it
turn?
Goes? Yeah.
So, well, I would go with Pickford. And I think it's like a... I mean, the interesting thing on England is... I think you know pretty well fullbacks and forward. Okay, there's the ball-playing midfielder issue that Jack Wilkes will probably get, but I don't know who you... Southgate's going to play a three, and I just don't know which three centre-backs I'd pick. Not because there are so many brilliant ones, but I don't know. I don't know if any of you do. There we go. Watford 1, Everton 0 in the Marco Silva derby. the best bit of which was Troy Deeney getting the Man of the Match award and saying, well, I'm the best of a bad bunch. Cheers.
Did somebody say
it? Yeah.
I did enjoy Martin Keown suggesting that Everton would win because it was cold and Watford have a lot of foreigners.
Ah, oh, good. That's, good old Martin.
I mean, and just let's actually just look into this. Jan Mutt is from Leiderschendam, sorry, Holland, in Netherlands, where it's minus one today. Decore is from Merlin et Yvelin, in the sort of northerny bit of France, where it is today minus two. Kapoor is from Niort, where it's also minus two. José Holabas is Greek, but was born in Aschaffenburg in Germany, where it is minus four today. And of course, Sebastian Prodl is from Linz, where it is currently minus nine. So, just as a public service announcement, I know English people, when you go abroad, it is generally to somewhere where it's warm. That's fine. I do that too. But not all foreign places are warm at all times. We have the cold abroad. I lived in Finland for a while. It was minus 30 in the winter. Foreign is not always warm. Foreign, sometimes cold.
Because the Winter Olympics, they were held in foreign, weren't they?
Yes, they were. Yeah, and it was quite cold.
Looked quite nippy.
Yeah.
In the Football League, in the Championship, Wolves lost 2-0 to Fulham. Ryan Sessegnon and on loan Alexander Mitrovic with the goals. Wolves haven't won in three. Panic. Fulham are fifth and unbeaten in 12. They've won eight in a row at home, just 5 points off the automatic promotion spots. Second place Cardiff are on a good run. They've won their last four. Cut the gap to Wolves to 6 points by beating Bristol City 1-0. At the bottom, what an exciting point for Sunderland against Middlesbrough, Baz.
Yeah, it was a very eventful game. Sunderland took the lead and then lost it and rescued a point in a match which had players sent off from either side. Rescued a point in the sixth or seventh minute of added time. Mm. So that was all very exciting. I'm not sure how much use that point will be, but... how many points from safety are there?
Well, you're on 27 and Barnsley have 31.
Yes, and the poor goal difference is a point as well.
Well, your goal difference minus 24 is not as bad as Burton minus 34 and Birmingham minus 29, but they could both get relegated and you could also be relegated. Amy?
Well, was there a penalty in that game? I only say that because Jonathan Wilson tweeted something about the last time that any Sunderland goalkeeper had saved a penalty was about two centuries ago.
Yeah, Tony Norman was in goals. So I think that's the 80s.
60s or whatever it was. Just an amazing stat.
Yes, a lot of amazing things happen.
They were still at Roker Park anyway, certainly. I think it was mid-80s.
Grant Leadbitter scored the penalty and then didn't celebrate.
Well, he didn't celebrate because his dad's... he's a Sunderland old boy, and his father, when he died, I think had his ashes scattered or buried somewhere on the pitch at the Stadium of Light. So Grant Leadbitter scored his penalty for Borough and just ran over to the spot where his dad's ashes were, you know, in repose or whatever, and just touched the ground. It was
a nice touch. Would you have your ashes spread over the Stadium of Light,
no.
Barry?
No,
where would they be? That pub in Brixton, isn't it?
I don't know. Put them on your mantelpiece.
Oh, seriously? Are you suggesting, is it guaranteed that I'll outlive you?
I had a mate actually staying with me over the weekend, and his parents, they're in an urn somewhere in North London, and he needs somewhere to put them for a while. And I could see he was tiptoeing around the issue of asking, would it be all right if he left his parents in a jar in my house, which I'm not sure I'm entirely comfortable with.
As far as house guests go, I mean, they're pretty unfussy.
Well, they're low maintenance, but I just nothing
not
good
loud
can come of it. I'll end up like accidentally knocking them over, spilling them.
But you could
that's
replace,
a nice ashtray, Barry, isn't
throwing
it?
Them out.
You could just replace them, and how would he know?
I don't think he'd be that fussy.
So
honest.
There we go.
He has to dispose of them according to their wishes during the summer, and so he needs somewhere to keep them in the meantime. And, they're going to end up on my mantelpiece.
I visited some friends recently, and they had a horse who had died recently, and they had the remains of the horse in
what, a bucket.
Well, no, it's in a box, but
ashes.
Yeah, but
they cremated a horse. A horse?
Yes. But it was very heavy, and they were warned when they were taking it away to prepare themselves for the weight of the box.
Bend from the knees, not the back, when you're picking up a cremated horse.
That's all I can add to this conversation.
Well, funnily enough, that pal of mine who's...
When she's dead, obviously.
That pal of mine who wants to leave his folks in my house till the summer, his wife's dad died, and they were disposing of the ashes down by on a beach somewhere, and his kids were eating ice cream anyway, and they threw daddy out of the urn, or granddad out of the urn, but he blew back in the kids' faces because they'd been eating ice cream. Granddad ended up stuck all over the mouths and noses, and there were a lot of tears and tantrums, and my mate was like, oh god, this could only happen to me. And he looked to his wife, and she was like shoulders heaving and, you know, racking with sobs, but it turned out she was crying with the laughter.
It's what they would have wanted, isn't it?
Terrify the children one more time.
In League One, obviously, wins for five of the sides who now make up the top six. Only fifth placed Scunthorpe failed to get 3 points, drawing with Bristol Rovers, Blackburn and Shrewsbury in the top two. Third placed Wigan beat bottom side Rochdale 1-0. Rochdale's next game is at Wembley in the FA Cup against Spurs. A high drama at Rotherham. Doncaster were 1-0 up after 90 minutes, but two long injury breaks meant lots of injury time. Rotherham equalised in the 93rd minute before scoring the winner with a 103rd minute penalty. Oh, that's brilliant. Oxford still have no manager. The new owner says Craig Bellamy is one of four candidates they're speaking to about the vacant manager's job. Sol Campbell's been ruled out already. I interviewed him on Friday, Sol Campbell, on the wireless to talk about his...
I've wrote a column about him today.
Have you? Well, he was on this Arsenal podcast called Highbury and Heels, where he described himself as one of the greatest minds in football. He said, maybe it was a lack of experience, things like that, but it's a full circle experience. How do I get experience? I need a job to get experiences. I don't want to go too low that it's a struggle. I don't want to go too low that I'm under someone and thinking, what am I doing here? I would rather be managing a club myself. What do you say, Barry?
Well, either fairly or unfairly, because I don't know Sol Campbell, but he does have a reputation for being a bit weird and a bit of an egomaniac. Daniel Taylor wrote this story a few years ago, which I referenced in the column I did about Sol today, about the then Minister for Sport staging this powwow to try and, you know, figure out, involving the PFA, the Football League, Premier League, and to try and find out why there aren't enough, or why there are so few black and ethnic minority managers in football. And Sol Campbell was invited along, and he was asking Dan Ashworth, the FA technical director, you know, why Gary Neville had been fast-tracked to become Roy Hodgson's assistant as England manager, which is an entirely fair question. And Ashworth was explaining to him, and Sol Campbell interrupted and went, but I'm Sol Campbell. And Dan Ashworth didn't really know what to say to this, so he continued with his explanation and finished it and looked at Sol, and to which the reply came again once more with feeling, but I'm Sol Campbell. So this seemed to be his answer to everything. And I think that might be the reason he's not getting considered for jobs. Like, he said he applied for 10, he got 3 interviews. That seems a reasonable return when you think about how many applicants each position must attract. And I suspect the reason is if he's not getting these jobs is nothing to do with colour. And to be fair, he hasn't said it's because he's black, but other people have extrapolated this. But I think it might just be because he's Sol Campbell.
Well, I interviewed him on Friday, he came on Fantasy Football when I did that show with Merce. And he's not a sort of big I am... Well, certainly in my experience, he's not someone to come in and go, you know, I'm the best thing in the world. But he seems to have a real issue with communication, because we did this interview, and then obviously the reaction to it, and social media is not the barometer, but it was very much like, this guy, you know, doesn't have any humility, he's arrogant. And I don't feel that about him as a person when I've met him. But if he's got a problem with communication on an interview on the radio station and an interview with a job, I suspect he might have an issue with communication with players.
Yeah, I think that's really perceptive there, Max.
The first time I've been here since August.
I've met him a couple of times as well, and I would say that he's quite a complex character, actually, more so than, you know, it's very easy to take a look at the stereotype, and he does, when you talk about his communication thing, have a tendency sometimes to say things that maybe come out a bit wrong and don't necessarily give the best impression. I mean, I think there are, you know, some people who will never have a good idea about certain people because we get preconceived ideas really quickly. He has been quite a controversial figure for, you know, choices he made in his career. In some people's eyes, that's the case anyway. But if you look at his career as well, he's done things that are quite complicated. I mean, leaving Tottenham, being their captain to sign for Arsenal was a complex choice. It wasn't the easy choice. He could have gone at that point in his career to quite a number of big clubs in Europe, chose to take one that he knew is going to open yourself up to being in a strange position, let's put it that way. But even I remember a time when he was at Arsenal, he walked out of a game at half time against West Ham. And that was like, what on earth is, what's going on there? That's not something that somebody does unless there's something complex going on somewhere. So I'm not quite sure where I'm going with this ramble, but except to say that it's not necessarily the case that everything is quite what it seems, I think, with him. But yeah, it probably impacts on the fact that it's not that easy for him to get the job that he wants.
I mean, this is a coincidence, but the juxtapositioning is interesting. The week where Sol Campbell says that he's one of the great minds in football, and that also that, yeah, it's a coincidence, but it's an interesting juxtaposition that in the week where Sol Campbell talks about whether he meant it like that or not, that he's one of the great minds in football, and he also says, I'm confident, and it's not like it's rocket science to run a football club, so it's easy to do this football club nonsense. That same week, Graham Potter, who went to Sweden to take over Östersunds when they're in the fourth tier of Swedish football, beat Arsenal at the Emirates. So in terms of not wanting to go too low because it's too tough, I mean, there are jobs out there if you're prepared to take chances that come along, even if they're not very glamorous or very financially rewarding, if you want to go and prove yourself.
I don't think it would be about finances or even necessarily glamour. I think there's that sense of if you're not in a environment that you're comfortable with, and if rightly or wrongly he perceives his football experience as having been pretty much at a high level. When he was a kid, he was at Lillisol, which is the elite. From teenage years, he's been at that level in his professional life, I suppose. So maybe there's an honesty. You could argue, I'm not sure, I'm playing devil's advocate a bit here because I don't know, but maybe there's an argument that some people think, I've got a fear of going to an environment I'm not quite sure about.
And also, that
might not work.
Yeah. Well, also, if football management, if you fail wherever you start, you're not going to get a job higher up. I mean, if you look at Teddy Sheringham going to Stevenage, you know, and actually you have to have an extraordinary knowledge of that league. And you can understand Oxford United looking at Sol Campbell going, hey, what's your knowledge of League One? What's your knowledge of the players we could possibly recruit? Well, that kind of thing. Apparently, Sol is in talks for the Grimsby job. They are 20th in League Two. They lost 1-0 to Exeter at the weekend. Elsewhere in League Two, leaders Luton got a last-minute equaliser at home to Cheltenham. Their next game is at the Fortress Abbey Stadium, where Cambridge have won one of their last one home games. They lost to second-place Accrington Stanley at the weekend. Astonishingly, five of the bottom seven in League Two won. There's still a five-point gap between third from bottom and the relegation zone. Chesterfield and Barnet are the two clubs who are adrift at the moment. Fitbar. After last week, we were accused of mocking Scottish football by a couple of people. And then a goalkeeper almost missed a game because he was run over by a cow. Queen of the South, Sam Henderson, was hit by a runaway cow on his dad's farm. He was an unused sub in their 0-0 draw with Dunfermline. Barry, have I stolen some of your football corner?
No.
No. Do you want me to carry on?
If you want.
Did you like the clip of Scott Brown?
I don't like much to do with Scott Brown.
Oh.
We were discussing flat track bullies last week, weren't we?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's, you put him on the list.
Okay.
But yeah, he's an odd character, great servant for Celtic, but
it's quite a good sort of, it's a good clip of him against Aberdeen being fouled by about 12 players. The final being a red card lunge by Sam Cosgrove, and then he sort of stands up and just flexes his muscles and is like, come on, I'll take you all on, a bit sort of like Bane.
It's a clip, you look at that. What sport is this?
Yeah.
What are they doing?
Well, that's fine and it's funny, but where was that aggression when Celtic were getting gone out of Europe with a whimper, getting their backsides handed to them by Zenit a few days previously? You know, he wasn't giving it the biggin in that game because he didn't do much, really. And it's, you know, Celtic, they've really let themselves down in Europe this season, I think. And they had a one-goal lead against a Zenit team that was only playing its second match since December because of their winter break. And they just capitulated. I thought it was a pretty feeble performance. But I suppose now I'll be accused of denigrating Scottish football again. But I'm not. They should be capable of better.
Of course, Zenit, a team full of foreigners, and it was very cold in that game. So the fact that they did anything at all is a damning indictment of Celtic, I think you have to say.
Hey, Lars, you're foreign. Tell us about Christopher Ayer, Celtic's young Norwegian centre-back.
I like him because he's very comfortable with the ball, and I think there's something you see increasingly at top-level football is that defenders can't just be big, strong fellas who kick the ball away when they have it. He's played as a midfielder quite. He's played up front a little bit as well because he's a big unit, but he's very, very calm and good with the ball, and I think he... going to Celtic was very clever of him, even if he had to go out on loan first, because he's finding his feet there in a league that's a much higher level, well, a higher level than the Norwegian league, but it's not a crazy high level for him. It's a good place for him to have an apprenticeship period. And I think because of the qualities that he have, because he is physically strong, but he's also very confident and composed on the ball, I think he's one to watch, definitely, in terms of a future career at a very big club.
Okay, great. That'll do for part two. We'll start part three in Spain with Sid. Welcome back to part three of Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain with Sid. Sid, how are you? Where do we find you?
Very well, thank you. You find me just leaving the house.
Okay, marvellous. How was your weekend? Six of the top 7-1, and the only only ones who didn't was Sevilla, who lost to Atletico in a ridiculous game.
Yeah, it was a ridiculous game, and very kind of un-Atletico as well, in that, you know, this is a team that, defensively, this is their worst performance of the season, Atletico Madrid. They let in two goals, which has only happened once before all season. But it didn't really matter, because they scored five. And they score five with kind of Costa basically producing the most Costa minute and a half of football you could ever imagine, running up the wing, pushing people over, provoking a confrontation from which he then hits the deck, even though he hasn't been hit in the face, despite the fact that that's what he's holding. Sevilla get the free kick. Costa complains to the referee. Sevilla take the free kick, play it back to the goalkeeper, who gives it to Venegas on the edge of the area. At this point, Costa's turned around, acting as if he's not interested, suddenly turns, takes the ball off Venegas and scores. And that all happens in a minute and a half, including the amount of time it takes to protest to the referee and everything. And Atletico, it was a really significant performance, because Sevilla have only been beaten once at home in over a year. Atletico have been beaten there by them in the Copa del Rey. And this is the beginning of a run of four away games for Atletico Madrid, which is Sevilla, Barcelona, Villarreal and Real Madrid. And they overcame it. And they're now only 7 points behind Barcelona, which, of course, they were before the round of games as well. But there's a real sense that this is a side now that can compete for the league, as I say, not least because on Sunday they go to Barcelona. If they win that, there will very definitely be a title race on.
Barcelona won again. They got a very brief scare from Girona.
Yeah, I quite like the way that Pablo Machin put it, the Girona manager, afterwards. Girona were 1-0 up after 2 minutes. Really nice goal from Porto, who's been brilliant this season. In fact, the whole of the Girona side has been brilliant this season. And he said after the game, yeah, but we made the mistake of awakening the beast. And then Messi was absolutely fantastic in a 6-1 win. He got two. Luis Suarez got a hat-trick. What Luis Suarez didn't get, though, was the yellow card he was so desperate to get in the last 10 minutes. It was kind of comic watching him do increasingly obvious fouls. And at one stage, he even seems to turn around to the referee and lift a finger up to him as if to say, come on, just one card, that's all I'm asking for. The referee, knowing what his game was, he wanted to get a suspension for Las Palmas and be clean from the Atletico Madrid game for the rest of the season. The referee just stubbornly refused to play along and just wouldn't get out the yellow card for him.
Oh, that is brilliant. What about Real Madrid? Straightforward for them?
Yeah, all three of the BBC scoring, which I think is the first time since April last year. Cristiano Ronaldo is playing really, really, really well now. He's he seems to look that little bit slimmer. He's quick. He's scoring goals. He gave up a hat-trick to give a penalty to Benzema so that Benzema could score. And I think, you know, it's something we've seen a lot before, but it's happened kind of almost more exaggeratedly than in the past. The European Cup has completely revived them yet again.
What are Celta Vigo doing this season? See, they got a couple of players in the top scorers charts. Aspas and Gomez.
Well, they're a weird team, Celta. I mean, actually, this weekend they beat Eibar, which puts them into seventh place, which will almost certainly, I mean, unless something amazing happens to Sevilla, and then they win the Copa del Rey, and I would an amazing collapse in the league, and they win the Copa del Rey, seventh place will be a European position. So Celta are in that final European position, having taken it off Eibar this weekend, and I suppose basically that's what you'd expect from them. But they're a curious team because they play some really nice football at times. They chase teams down almost one-on-one all over the pitch. They use the ball well. They're very attacking. But somehow it never quite convinces, or at least they have long spells when it doesn't quite convince. So last Monday, for example, I was in Getafe and they beat them 3-0, and they were frankly awful. And yet then this weekend, again, pretty awful the first half. Eibar, the better team, but they came through it to win. And Aspas is a brilliant player, and I know Liverpool fans probably won't believe that. And Maxi is very interesting because this is a guy who came from Uruguay. No one really knew very much about him. By the winter window, he was wanted by a Chinese club. I must confess, I can't remember which one. He said no, wants to stay, wants to be in Uruguay and scored for the summer. And he's scoring loads and loads of goals. Very powerful, very direct, quite Uruguayan, I suppose, in that sense. And actually, if you look at La Liga, him, Stuani and Luis Suarez, three Uruguayans in the top, I think might be the top six or top seven goal scorers in Spain.
We discussed in quite a bit of detail Pep's yellow ribbon and wearing it and the trouble he's got in from the FA. I just wonder what reaction there's been in Spain from that.
Well, in a way, I mean, and I know I say this to you all the time and I kind of hate to repeat myself on it, but it sort of depends which side of the divide you're on. So as you can imagine, and this obviously goes much, much deeper than just a footballing divide, although that's always kind of partly present as well. It's a political one in this case, that the immense majority of people who kind of support the Catalan cause, or at the very least support the right to decide and the right for a referendum and so on, see Guardiola as very principled, as standing up to an absurd law and saying, right, well, if it's a fine, there's a fine, I'll pay it and I'll just keep doing this. Obviously, from the other side, there's much more of a kind of a sort of a straightforward dismissal of it, as you know, Guardiola is again challenging the rule. Guardiola is again kind of getting himself in trouble. And then there are some who obviously take it the next step beyond that, which is to ask questions about Guardiola's commitment to democracy in terms of, you know, the club that he plays for, in terms of his support for Qatar, for example. But as I say, as so often in Spain, it depends which side you're on.
Finally, anything to watch out for in the midweek fixtures?
I actually think, to be honest with you, that the midweek fixtures are relatively dull. I'm kind of hopeful that what we'll be looking out for is the resurgence of the three teams that shouldn't be competing for Europe, but were, and then most of them dropping points so we can get back into it. But know that the big thing is, as I say, it's all about the weekend, and it's all about Atletico going to Barcelona.
Sid, as always, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
From Sid in Spain to Italy, Barry, relegated, sacked from your piazza, as we get a roundup from someone who knows about Italian football in Paolo Bandini.
The big story of the weekend in Serie A was Milan winning 2-0 away at Roma and really putting the cap back among the pigeons in the Champions League race. Now, who would have imagined us saying that back at the start of the year when they were still in the bottom half of the table? They'd already had Gennaro Gattuso in charge for more than a month at that point. I think a lot of us thought he was out of his depth, thought he was the wrong manager at the wrong time. However, he has proved us all wrong, because that's now 12 games unbeaten, and this was a signature win. Milan had not won away at Roma in Serie A since 2011, which was a team that would have had Zlatan Ibrahimovic in it, Alessandro Nesta in it, a team that was used to competing for titles, which is what this team was supposed to be after they invested nearly €250 million in transfers this summer. But we hadn't seen it until recently. Finally, it's starting to click. You saw this weekend players like Leonardo Bonucci, Lucas Piglia, really starting to respect their role in the team, not try to do too much, and it is working. So is the bringing through of some really exciting young players. Patrick Cutrone, who scored the opening goal, has now got 5 in his last 7 games. This is a kid who was in the Milan youth system from the age of 7 years old, got to learn in the youth team from Pippo Inzaghi as a coach, and then in the first team from Vincenzo Montella, and is really starting to make good on that footballing education. So Milan are now 7 points behind Inter, fourth place Inter. They are in that conversation for the Champions League again, and the teams in front of them are stumbling and beginning to feel the breath on the back of their necks. I think it's going to be a really compelling end to that race this season. But the other big story this weekend was a game that didn't happen. Juventus was supposed to be hosting Atalanta. That game got snowed off, and it's a blow for Juventus because it would have been a good time to face Atalanta, who'd had a Europa League heartbreak against Borussia Dortmund in the week. And we're going to be starting three players who are yet to start a game in Serie A this season. So a heavily rotated side. If Juventus had won that game, they could have gone ahead of Napoli at the top of the table. Instead, Napoli get to play tonight with a chance, on Monday night, with a chance to go 4 points clear and put the pressure back on Juventus. He'll have to catch that game up later in the year.
Paolo Bandini reporting there from his toilet. Would anybody like to hear Italy's version of Jeff Stelling's reaction when Milan's 21-year-old right-back David Calabria scored his goal?
Yes.
Here it is.
Tiziano! Calabria! 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 Su assist di Karinic! Calabria! 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 Calabria!
Calabria with the goal.
Was he also in Paolo's toilet?
I think so. Yeah, everyone. That's where everyone is.
All the cool kids.
That's where they hang out.
There was me lording it up in my piazza when all the fun was going on in Paolo's latrine.
Well, interestingly, not only is that man, Italian Jeff Stelling, in Paolo's toilet, Archie Rintutt has a German update also from Paolo Bandini's toilet.
There's only one place to start this week, and that is in the Bundesliga 2, because Duisburg were playing Ingolstadt, and Hope goalkeeper Mark Flecken was the unexpected star. 18 minutes gone, Duisburg were one up, and they scored a second, or so Flecken thought, because he turned round for a swig of water in his own goal, but little did he realise that the goal had been disallowed up the other end for offside. So, seconds later, as Flecken turned round, to his horror, Stefan Kutschke was touching the ball into Flecken's net to equalise for Ingolstadt. This has been a viral sensation, which Flecken can laugh about because Duisburg went on to win 2-1, and his teammates had a laugh too by sticking 15 water bottles in his locker the following day. All in all, water disaster. Sorry. Elsewhere in Germany on Saturday, league leaders of the Bundesliga, Bayern Munich, drew 0-0 at home with Hertha Berlin. Quite a shock that, the first time they failed to score at home in 69 games in all competitions, and a big blow in their race to wrap up the title in March. Then, you had one of Germany's biggest derbies, the Nordderby, between Werder Bremen and Hamburg, which was won 1-0 late on by Werder, whilst the Hamburg fans let off fireworks from the away end towards the end of the first half. Hamburg are only off bottom spot now, even on goal difference, after last place Cologne beat Champions League chasing Leipzig 2-1. That was probably the biggest shock of the weekend. And good news that for Schalke, who beat Leverkusen on Sunday in what was a big game for all things top four. Nabil Bentaleb, you might remember him, he clinched it for Schalke from the penalty spot. Important for him, having been left out for a bad attitude recently. And Spurs fans, I dare say, might remember that too. A few more things. Firstly, props to the magnificently named Mandela Egbo, 20 years old, English defender, moved from Palace to Gladbach in 2015, had to persevere with spells in and out of the second team and injury as well, but got 11 minutes at Hanover this weekend as he made his Bundesliga debut. And protests are continuing over Monday night games. Most of the yellow wall, in fact, is set to be empty when Augsburg travel to Dortmund, and they edged past Atalanta in the Europa League on Thursday, with Leipzig doing the same to Napoli.
Why would a goalie need a drink so badly in sort of January? It's not that hot. He's probably not exerted himself that much.
Maybe he's got like tea or something. Yeah. He's got a warming drink of some kind.
He could have sneaky booze whiskey in there. He might be a really bad alcoholic.
Asmir Begovic is, every time they concede a goal, there's constant shots of Asmir Begovic having a little sip on his drink bottle, I've noticed. Back into my boulangerie, only one win in the top six this weekend in France. No prizes for guessing, it was PSG who got it. They beat third-placed Marseille 3-0. Neymar rolled his ankle and left the pitch on a stretcher in tears. He has sprained it. They play Real Madrid in 8 days' time. Unai Emery said, "If today I had to say yes or no for Neymar to be fit against Real Madrid, I would say yes. I want to be optimistic." Five draws in the 10 games. PSG, Rennes, Dijon, Amiens and Angers. The only team to take 3 points this weekend. On to any other business. Barry, Christian Vieri and the header. This is exciting. Kay Murray, who is a presenter in Be In Sports in the USA, sent us a message to say, "Hi everyone, Christian Vieri is a panelist on the show I host, and they played the audio of us talking about Henry Moffitt's question." Henry Moffitt, a man who just stopped me in the street to ask me about whether Christian Vieri ever scored a header from outside the box. They asked Christian Vieri on telly, and his face was absolutely blank, and he has no memory of the goal. And about 15 minutes later, she replied again to say, "Breaking news. With Inter, Christian Vieri did not score a goal from the edge of the box, but he just said with Torino in 91-92, he scored a header from the edge of the box in the Coppa Italia versus Lazio, thanks to a cross from Lentini." You do wonder, I hope they didn't sit there for 15 minutes while Christian Vieri was just sitting there thinking.
I hope they did.
So look.
Thank you very much, Kay.
Thank you, Kay. And there you go, Henry. It was worth stopping me in the street for that. A final word on the header comes from Ed Jackson. The greatest header, the thing that would encapsulate the header in football, Amy. Ed Jackson's a journalist in Australia, sent me a link to the Sugar Puffs advert where Kevin Keegan signs the Honey Monster for Newcastle and he rises high to put a bullet header in at the far post. On great sportsmen missing limbs and fingers, Andy McDougall sent me a message saying one of my relatives was apparently the one-armed golf champion of Great Britain. You'd think you'd know, wouldn't you, if you're related to him, that you'd either know or you didn't if one of your relations was the one-armed golf champion of Great Britain. And finally, Paul says, Max...
So if that golf champion minded his handicap really carefully, would he be a one-armed bandit?
Well, Paul says, Max, if you had to nominate a single footballer that you'd trust to catch, trap, control a falling toddler using only their feet and natural ability, who would you go for? Bergkamp all day long, says Paul. Berbatov,
yeah.
Any advances on Berbatov?
Maradona.
Yes, good. Yeah. I don't think you need to sound as surprised when you suggest Maradona for that.
Sorry, I don't know. I was actually really thinking about that.
Romelu Lukaku.
Yes, with Berbatov, you worry if he really, like, if at any given moment, if he's bothered.
That's a good point.
If he can be bothered to do it, maybe it's just... Nah.
Okay.
On the headers, you completely neglected Jonas Samuelsson's header from his own half in the Norwegian league.
No, but we were sceptical of headers from long range.
It's from his own half, though, to be fair. It's for 57 metres.
Well, that might be good.
It's a good header. The goalkeeper had gone up for a corner, so there's an empty net.
I'm afraid to say anyone who uses metres in football is also wrong, because it's always yards. Barry, this is the last word of the pod. Make it brilliant.
God, no, I was just going to say, if you know, to save a toddler being dropped from a high building, would it be Bergkamp with his feet or Bravo with his, but he's allowed to use his arms? You had to pick one.
I would put faith. If I'm taking it really literally, I would have faith in Claudio Bravo catching him.
Yeah, and then kicking him 70 yards down the street.
Barry, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Lars.
All good.
Thanks, Amy.
Cheers.
Back on Thursday.